The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
State of Obama and the GOP. President spotlights smaller goals and more executive action facing a fragmented opposition and critical midterm elections.
Closing the gaps, both income and mobility. Can our economic system let the rich get richer without the poor and middle class getting poorer?
Letter to Snowden. A veteran editor calls the fugitive NSA leaker a hero who should come home now to praise and punishment if a jury so decides.
Burlesque to Broadway. A new look and contemporary songs revive classic jokes, revealing costumes, and the eternal female form.
Pete passes. Folk singer Seeger at 94 with a legacy of powerful music, traditional and original, well-seasoned with social conscience and ageless activism.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only for the week of February 2nd and the Super Bowl, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Congress needs to restore the unemployment insurance you just let expire for 1.6 million people. Say yes. Give America a raise. Give them a raise. Wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
But the most important moments right now aren't happening here. They're not in the Oval Office or in the House chamber. They're in your homes, kissing your kids goodnight, figuring out how to pay the bills, getting ready for tomorrow's doctor's visit.
President Obama's fifth State of the Union address stressed economic inequality and the president's ability to do something about it by executive action if a gridlocked Congress won't work with him. Disagreement even within the Republican Party was underscored by four different GOP responses, and the May one by Washington State's Kathy McMorris Rogers, highest-ranking woman in the House GOP leadership, began by downplaying the importance of government itself as both parties jockey for support in this year's midterm elections.
To consider the state of Obama and of the GOP, including new allegations against its former top White House prospect, Chris Christie of New Jersey, as well as issues from inequality to immigration to the environment, for your ears only, we're joined again by Julian Zelizer, Princeton professor of history and public affairs, author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So some critics called Obama's speech too small bore. Others found it necessarily realistic and self-reliant, given the House GOP opposition that he faces. What's your view?
Well, I think these were the only ideas that are possible. I think he made a decision not to set himself up with soaring oratory that was never going to happen on Capitol Hill. And instead, he's taking a pragmatic, realistic view to do what is possible about questions like inequality.
Should he have stressed more tax reform to close loopholes that unfairly benefit the rich and to increase incentives for more, example, domestic hiring, especially of the long-term unemployed?
Yeah, I think it's surprising he didn't do more with that. I think tax reform is one of those issues that resonates with both parties, even in the current polarized era. A lot of Republicans have been talking about tax reform. And so that is an issue that I think he really needs to make front and center. It's a way to raise money. It's a way to address problems like the long-term unemployed. And it's an issue that he shouldn't let go in the coming months.
Can Obama use executive authority to add that kind of incentive to new federal contracts, as he did the requirement for a higher minimum wage?
It's possible. I don't know the options he has available. Certainly with the minimum wage, he was within his boundaries, and executive action allows you to do that with federal contracting. And my guess is right now the White House is looking at the entire menu of executive authority options that's available. And if that is one of them, I'm sure it will come up in this summit that Obama's called with business leaders over the long-term unemployed.
There were predictable Republican complaints about Obama's promise of more executive action, though Democrats said some past GOP presidents have used it more. What does history show about how frequently and effectively executive action has been used?
It's been used since the nation was founded. It's increased in frequency during the 20th century, especially starting in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt, and all presidents use executive orders, signing statements. President Obama has actually used it much less than most presidents. He's been very reluctant to use executive power, except on a few issues like immigration. So the Republican complaints are a bit hypocritical. Obviously, President Bush used executive power very aggressively. So I think part of the complaints is just partisan politics.
Immigration is one area where Obama has already used presidential power, easing up on deportations of those undocumented brought here as children, the so-called Dreamers. Do you see him broadening that to more of the 11 million here not convicted of crimes, especially as Republicans remain divided over legal status for them, not to mention a path to citizenship?
I think at this point that will remain more of a threat. The news this week was that the Republicans are open and talking about immigration reform, not necessarily a path to citizenship, but some kind of legal status. And that's his preference. President Obama prefers the legislative route. So he won't move too fast on executive power in that area because he wants to leave open the possibility of a big deal with the GOP to turn this into a bill.
Another decision facing Obama is the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada, now that the State Department has found no significant environmental objections. Would a presidential green light seriously alienate his party's powerful green constituency? And what do you think he'll do?
I think he'll do it. I do think he's prepared to green light this, and he's prepared to have his green constituency still angered with him. They're already frustrated with him over this and other issues. I don't think President Obama is very optimistic he can win them back. This is an area he's compromised, and my guess is he'd rather have this issue gone and focus on what he's really concerned about right now, which is inequality and the middle class.
Were you surprised the president said so little about the NSA surveillance controversy, as well as the escalating civil conflict in Syria, where the Assad regime is now reported to be seriously behind on the Obama-backed deal to eliminate chemical weapons?
No, I don't think he wants to bring up the NSA surveillance any more than others bring it up for him. He's put forward the reforms he's comfortable with. In general, I don't think he wants to overturn the program. I think he's happy with it, frankly. And so at this point, he would like whatever reforms he's willing to do go through, but generally keep the issue silent. So this isn't the kind of State of the Union issue that he's going to want to focus on. Similar with the Assad regime, right now that region is a mess. I don't think the administration is fully comfortable on what they're going to do. So it's, once again, the kind of issue they don't want to use the power of the presidency to highlight. Rather, they'd want to focus attention elsewhere.
Looking ahead to political jockeying for the midterm elections and the environment for the 2016 presidential race, what do you make of new allegations from a Chris Christie ally on the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey that lane closing on the George Washington Bridge was on the Christie administration's order and that Christie knew about them at the time despite his later denial?
Well, what we know so far is that this keeps the issue alive. Many people thought it was going to die down, and this revelation and potential embarrassment for the governor has brought the issue front and center on Super Bowl weekend once again. And so the problem expands. It's becoming a big problem, certainly for his presidential bid.
Early in the scandal, you wrote about the way other leaders under scrutiny have salvaged political careers by raising questions about the motives of their accusers. Is that still an option with a top federal prosecutor on his case?
It's still an option, and I think what we see is scandals can unfold in many ways. It could bring someone down quickly, and that is possible, but they can also fizzle or they can also become seen as partisans.
But even with no further evidence of a Christie connection to Bridgegate, does he have to suffer for permitting an environment that encouraged such political hardball, or is it just Jersey?
It is Jersey, and he will suffer. It's not necessarily about corruption, but the appearance of corruption can be very damaging. And even if some of this is very familiar in the Garden State, I think nationally it could start to play badly. And just as important, it can create an incentive for other candidates for 2016, like a Jeb Bush, to get into the race where previously they wouldn't, and that can really hurt him.
Princeton professor of history and public affairs Julian Zelizer is author of Jimmy Carter and Governing America.
Quote from the news, the buck stops with me. That was Georgia Governor Nathan Deal apologizing for inadequate preparation by state and Atlanta region officials after only several inches of unusual snowfall produced hours of icy gridlock for motorists, students, and many others, despite early predictions of the rare winter storm. Quote, I don't want to get into the blame game, said Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed, a rising Democratic star.
Next, closing the gaps, income and mobility, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. They don't think they will lose customers. They're doing this from a position of strength. That was analyst Gene Munster on Amazon's decision to counteract disappointing revenue by raising the cost of Amazon Prime delivery by as much as 50%. Also last week, second quarterly earnings fell sharply at ExxonMobil and Shell because of a declining oil price and increasing production costs. Now this.
No, I don't understand the poor. No, I don't understand the poor. The lives they lead of want and need. Well, I should think it would be a bore. There seems to be nothing but stubbornness. Oh, what's all the suffering for? To be so debased is in terrible taste. I don't understand the poor.
That comic ditty from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, the new Broadway musical, captures the widening gap in an economy that's no laughing matter outside. And especially, it seems, in some corners of Capitol Hill, whose denizens see a big part of the problem in precisely those government programs and proposals meant to help the long-term and newly poor in a recovery that's done less for jobs and wages than for stock prices and banker bonuses.
Winning praise for putting a human face on the victims of automation, global free trade, and employment outsourcing is a book titled Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, just out in paperback from the Anchor Press. And to talk about it, as well as about new political concern with income inequality, economic immobility, and what to do about them, for your ears only, the author of that book joins us now. She's Barbara Garson, whose earlier works about economics and real people include The Electronic Sweatshop and All the Live Long Day. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First, describe the diversity of formerly middle-class Americans you spent time with, the jobs they once held or to which they barely cling now.
Well, I spoke to a group of people in New York that formed a pink slip club out of their church when they discovered they were all unemployed. They were an insurance adjuster, an editor, someone who did the graphics for business books, there was one woman who, it may not sound professional to you, she was a saleswoman for a high-end Madison Avenue boutique. But she earned very high commissions, and she'd been doing this all her life. The first three became unemployed completely. And they assumed that they would get new jobs, and they never really did. The woman who worked in the Madison Avenue boutique, it made sense to her at first, since business had dropped, that the company would say, well, we're working shorter hours. But then, I spoke to these people over a course of years. Then she said to me, I noticed something funny. They're still hiring people. They're giving us shorter hours, but they're taking in college girls who are working for $8 an hour. Well, what do you know? As the recession proceeded, and as a matter of fact, as things started to get better, they called in the whole staff and they said, look, you can stay if you want, but we're now all working by the hour. We have no more health insurance, no more commissions, and if you want to quit, we won't contest your unemployment insurance. So unemployment insurance became sort of their severance pay. And a whole swath of very good jobs becomes a job for college kids. The point is that no one else will have that good job anymore. So none of us have come out of this recession, so to speak.
With so many millions suddenly heading down what was previously an economic up escalator, what do you think explains the absence of an organized labor pushback as this country saw during the Great Depression of the 1930s, or is it coming in some reincarnation of Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, I hope it will come. It did take longer during the recession. The Great Depression. It did take more than a year or two. I don't know. I wish it were there. We begin to see the demand for higher minimum wages. I'm hoping that will lead to something.
Well, let's talk about some of the proposals that the president and others are making. You mentioned a minimum wage beyond what he's now guaranteeing under new federal contracts. What about all the talk of better vocational training and retraining? Does that seem relevant to the people that you spoke with in New York and around the country for this book?
You know, if there really was not enough people to fill skilled jobs, then under the all-powerful law of supply and demand, wages would be going up. And I imagine there are a few places where people say, oops, I better pay a little more. I really can't get someone who can do this. But for the most part, the people who are saying, I can't fill the job, have been lowering the wages. And so I'm not sure I'm not opposed to training people to do math and learn how to do things, but I really don't think a skills gap explains why people are unemployed at this point. As I said, otherwise wages would be going up, but the pressure to keep them down is so great.
What about the new international trade agreements that Obama says will create more jobs than union leaders say they will cost? What's been the outcome of past free trade pacts for the kind of people you profile in Up the Down Escalator?
I can't believe I would have to do this again. I spent so much time campaigning against NAFTA. First of all, don't call it a free trade agreement. Call it a trade agreement, because these agreements are between countries that already have unilateral free trade. What they are agreements not Mexico against the United States, but they're agreements of between the big businessmen of all those countries. And what they usually do is increase certain monopolies. Like, for instance, all the countries will now have the longest possible patents on medicine. That's not free trade. That's making very poor countries unable to go out and buy a Mexican or an Indian drug in order to protect the prices and raise the prices. These are agreements against us. They are not free trade agreements. I would be in favor of free trade, I think. I'm not certain. And as to the president's proposals, his other proposals, it's very good to give a little more wages to the new people who will be employed by federal government contractors. If I was already employed by one, I'd quit and ask for my job back at the new raise. But you can't do it by what the president suggested for other businesses, asking them to be nice and raise wages. I've spoken to a lot of business leaders about good things like raising wages or environmentally cleaning up. And those who are sincere say to me, make me do it. Please make me do it. Pass a law so that I and my competitors will have to pay more. Because otherwise, they would be doing something illegal if they did it out of the goodness of their heart. They would be taking money away from shareholders, and that is their fiduciary duty, not making nice, good, life good for the rest of us.
Barbara Garson is the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live, newly out in paperback from Anchor Books.
Here's a quote from the news. No, no way, no how. That was former American exchange student Amanda Knox on the question of returning to Italy, even before her second conviction for murder of a roommate there in 2007, which set the stage for extradition if she loses on appeal.
Next, an editor's letter to NSA leaker Edward Snowden, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "The biggest gamble with taxpayer money that USAID has ever made." That was Inspector General John F. Sopko on a previously suppressed report raising serious doubts about whether Afghanistan can be trusted with billions of dollars from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Now this.
Working with this Congress, I will reform our surveillance programs because the vital work of our intelligence community depends on public confidence here and abroad. The privacy of ordinary people is not being violated.
You know, it's bizarre. U.S. officials, present and former, are very free calling for Snowden to be done away with.
President Obama's State of the Union address made little more than passing reference to the controversy over NSA surveillance programs ignited by the leaks of Edward Snowden. But deeper down in the government, there's talk of actually assassinating the fugitive NSA contractor, at least according to former CIA analyst and White House briefer Ray McGovern. Many outside the government also see Snowden as a traitor. And Attorney General Eric Holder recently offered little better than a guilty plea and jail time if Snowden returned to the United States.
But others see Snowden as a heroic whistleblower. And two Norwegian lawmakers last week even nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize. Journalists, in particular, are divided. Patriotic, as most Americans, but partial to leaks as the lifeblood of so many prize-winning stories. Retired Newsweek magazine editor Larry Martz, a former president of the Overseas Press Club of America, recently published a letter to Snowden that reflects both views. And for your ears only, Martz joins us now to read and discuss it. Welcome to the program.
It's nice to be with you.
Why don't you start by reading some of the letter that you wrote to Snowden?
Dear Edward Snowden, first, my thanks. You have done a great service to your country by exposing the appalling range of the National Security Agency's abuses of our civil liberties, and you have triggered a great debate that I hope will end in reining them in. I'm not among those who call you a coward for your refusal to submit to prosecution for stealing secret documents and disclosing their contents, and for accepting temporary asylum in Russia. I don't see why you should have to risk being jailed for life to prove that you are a true whistleblower. I'm surprised, though, at how many reasonable people, including many of my colleagues in the Overseas Press Club of America, condemn you for avoiding prosecution. Obviously, I'm not speaking for the club, but I'm going to suggest that perhaps you should come home after all and face the music. You're in a precarious and unsustainable position in Russia. In effect, Vladimir Putin has you in his pocket as a pawn to push or sacrifice whenever he pleases, in his long game to defeat Western values. You have been reduced to dickering with Brazil, offering bits of information in exchange for asylum there, a dirty bargain that would further stain your image. The New York Times has sensibly urged the government to offer you some form of clemency, to allow you to come home and be a voice for civil liberties. My sense is that that is highly unlikely to happen as long as you're on the run. But I think that if you do come back voluntarily, there will be a rising tide of conviction that you should not be punished for performing what has been a great public service. And you will have a good chance of being freed sooner rather than later. This may not happen. There will always be people clamoring for your head. You would be marching into the lion's den with no assurance that the beast will be tranquilized. But unless you do come home, it will be far more difficult to force our so-called protectors to end their abuses. Your service to the public has been huge, but it won't be completed until you turn yourself in. I'm sorry to have to say that. And whatever you decide to do, thanks again for what you have done.
Former Overseas Press Club of America President Larry Martz reading his recently published letter to Edward Snowden. Larry, what do you see as the most important of Snowden's leaks?
David, I think basically it's just the vast range of what he's done, of what they've done. We now know that they are grabbing the records of your phone, my phone, every phone in the United States. They are using that to run fishing expeditions and look further into anybody's records that attracts their notice. We've known for years that they were able to use so-called national security letters to go to the Verizon or Yahoo or whatever and say this guy is a security risk and therefore we need to look at his emails and tap his phone. But we haven't known the range of it. And now, thanks to Snowden, we know that there are 21,000 of these national security letters last year. That's 57 a day, and they don't even need court approval of any sort. They just write a letter and say, show us the records.
What did you make of President Obama's only minor mention of NSA surveillance in his State of the Union speech?
Well, I think it shows that he does not regard this as a serious problem, and I don't think we can expect very much action from him unless we keep the pressure on.
The director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, told Congress last week that Snowden had done grave damage to the nation's security, allowing terrorists to change their behavior so as to elude surveillance, though he offered no details. Do you see that encouraging those in or out of government who might actually think of trying to kill Snowden now or later?
Well, I hope not. I suspect that most people who take this very seriously had already concluded that he had done damage to national security, and I don't think Clapper's remark probably made that any worse. On the other hand, there are always crazy people who will decide that they can be heroes by taking the law into their own hands, and I'm afraid that's a serious threat.
Do you think Snowden's exposure of NSA surveillance has changed the media's coverage of the topic, and how good a job has it done along those lines?
Yes, the Snowden case has definitely, for one thing, it has given those of us who are worried about the risks of too much secrecy and too much abuses of personal security, it's given us an excuse to write a lot more about it. And I think it's changed the climate for that kind of story.
Larry Martz is a retired Newsweek editor and former president of the Overseas Press Club of America. You can read his open letter to Snowden at opcofamerica.org/blogs.
Here's a quote from the news. "Just the right thing to do." That was Boston Marathon bombing victim Mark Fucarelli on a Justice Department decision to seek the death penalty against bombing suspect Jokhar Tsarnaev.
Next, sex and song on stage for Your Ears Only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "Average and okay." That was advertising veteran Lee Garfinkel on this year's crop of Super Bowl ads, of which he thought the best were for Newcastle, Budweiser, and Heinz. Also making headlines before the big game was a spot featuring actress Scarlett Johansson for the home carbonation maker SodaStream, an Israeli company with a factory in the occupied West Bank. That connection forced an end to the star's 8 years as goodwill ambassador for Oxfam International, an aid group that finds such factories offensive to the Palestinian people. Now this.
So let me entertain you, and we'll have a real good time.
Don't tell her. Show her. I used to be Snow White. But I drifted.
Singer-dancer Quinn Lemley has borrowed songs from Broadway, Tin Pan Alley, and contemporary pop music, plus scanty costumes and fine figures, her own included, to revive, sanitize, and celebrate an earlier sexy stage genre known as burlesque. The show is called Burlesque to Broadway, playing February 5 through 8 at the Gramercy Theater in downtown New York. And to preview it for Your Ears Only, creator Star Lemley is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, David. I'm thrilled.
Let's start with you. Where are you from? How did you get into music and dance?
Well, I'm originally from Columbus, Indiana, south of Indianapolis, and I came out of the womb singing and dancing. I started being in plays and musicals when I was like 4 years old. So I love this music, and I love this show. It's so much fun.
Talk about studying opera with a great diva in France.
My mom had gotten a Rotary scholarship when I was 16, 17, and so we were in Bordeaux, and we studied with the great, she was the great mezzo of the Paris Opera, and her name was Christine Castelli, and I was her youngest student that she ever had at the conservatory, and that was really an experience to spend a year with a great diva like that. I learned a lot.
What attracted you to burlesque?
Well, I was touring at performing arts centers with my Rita Hayworth show with a 12-piece big band. And I wanted to do a new project, and I thought, Gypsy Rose Lee, we all know the musical Gypsy, but I thought, what about burlesque, and what was her act like, and what made her such a legend? I mean, she didn't really sing, and she didn't really dance, and really didn't take that much off. And so I started reading her biographies, and then I read June Havoc's and Mae West and Sally Rand. And it was so interesting because a lot of these women came out of the Depression, and they really used burlesque and vaudeville to break through glass ceilings by using the power of the T's in their mind, which I thought was really interesting, and how all of these women had similarities in their past.
What was the difference between burlesque and vaudeville? Was it just a question of how much skin got shown, or was there a different level of entertainment?
Well, there's always vaudeville in burlesque. Vaudeville was before burlesque. Burlesque really, they were simultaneous, but when vaudeville died, all those comics came into burlesque. But I would say the difference with burlesque and vaudeville is, is the striptease.
While burlesque traded on sex, at least on stage, you also find it to be a monument to traditional American and show business values. Talk a bit about that.
Yes, I do, because, all of these women, they use their mind, and they use their wit, and they use their sense of humor and their intelligence to create jobs for themselves and to become legends. And a lot of them didn't really take everything off back in the day. There was a sense of elegance to it. There was a sense of tongue-in-cheek. It was witty. It was funny. It was sexy. And so I think it glorifies the American girl, like Flo Ziegfeld did. All of these have elements. And when we think of Sonny and Cher show, or Bette Midler, they really used elements of burlesque and vaudeville within their acts. Sid Caesar, Jackie Gleason, with the jokes and the popes and all of so we wanted to incorporate all of that great history, American history, into the show.
Besides the biography, the biographies you read, how did you study the original burlesque for the jokes in the show, if not the song and dance? Are there many old film clips or audio recordings, even serious written reviews?
Yeah, there are some. There's some films. This was Burlesque, that was Ann Corio's show, that had a lot of the traditional things in it. But I did a lot of research and a lot of reading, and I really looked for the jokes and from different people, from Abbott and Costello and Mae West and Tallulah Bankhead, Burns and Allen. There's such a wealth of information, and all of those jokes are in print, and then I tried to research them to see how their delivery was, and not to steal from it, but to, be influenced by it.
Talk about your decision to avoid actual songs of the burlesque era and to use more modern music instead.
Well, I do use songs of the burlesque era or the American Songbook. I have songs of Irving Berlin and Cole Porter. We do an interesting version of My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And in burlesque, there are all these fantasies. And so we do it as the girls are in really sexy maid costumes. But the counterpoint I put to it was to Henry Mancini's Peter Gunn. So it makes for an interesting, edgy, something old and something new. But there's really diverse music for everyone in the show. There's music from Tom Jones, She's a Lady. Well, Paul Anka wrote it. There's Mel Brooks's If You've Got It Flaunted for the more Broadway audiences. And we have 10 Cents a Dance, which was Ruth Etting's big hit. So we really run the gamut musically.
Many shows wait to see if they're hits before committing to a cast album, but yours is already recorded. Was it hard to capture the spirit of the show in sound only?
We thought that it was going to be, especially because we had to do it in segments, but our producer, Paul Horton, and Dan Mitchell, our musical director, conductor, are so brilliant. It sounds like a live recording. Everything is so vibrant and live, and we had so much fun recording it.
Singer-dancer Quinn Lemley is creator and star of Burlesque to Broadway, playing February 5th through the 8th at the Gramercy Theater, 127 East 23rd Street in Manhattan, and burlesquetobroadway.com.
What beautiful jewels you have!
Goodness had nothing to do with it.
Quote from the news, if you can make it to kindergarten without the weight, your chances are immensely better. That was Amory Global Health Institute Vice President Dr. Jeffrey P. Copeland on a new study of 7,000 children showing that those obese by kindergarten will more likely remain so, and those not obese then we're less likely to become so.
Next, Pete Passes, folk singer Seeger, at 94. For Your Ears Only.
A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. Sensible gun reform and the Second Amendment can coexist. That was Dan Gross, president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, after a federal district court in Connecticut upheld the new state law requiring universal background checks for all gun sales and banning sale or possession of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Now this.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
With a not surprising sense of timing, iconic banjo and guitar-picking singer and activist Pete Seeger, avatar of the 1960s folk music revival, died at the age of 94 last week, just as the world was beginning to celebrate 50 years since the Beatles' invasion of America and the rock and roll revolution that quickly followed, overshadowing folk, pop, and much other music worldwide.
Born to a classical music family, Seeger celebrated working men and women, traditional music, and contemporary causes for which he wrote songs of his own, including Turn, 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 If I Had a Hammer, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and the anti-Vietnam anthem, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. With his energetic voice finally failed, he played on to lead others in song as he always had.
To reflect on the man and his music for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Norman A. Ross, a schoolmate of mine and former publisher of Broadside Magazine, a Bible of the folk revival. He also helped preserve and publish a short-lived Seeger TV series made after his lengthy left-wing blacklisting with Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash, Judy Collins, Theodore Bikel, Buffy St. Marie, the Clancy Brothers, Tommy Makem, and other folk favorites. Norman, welcome to our show.
Hi.
What's your favorite memory of Seeger?
There were two that were connected events that came to mind. In the early 80s, when I was publishing Broadside, we had a table to promote the magazine at the Clearwater Festival. And all of a sudden, there was a hand on my shoulder, and I turned around. It was Pete. And he pointed to some people opposite me who were just singing just for fun. It wasn't, you know, a concert or anything. And they were singing a song about Harriet Tubman. And he said, Norman, you have to get that song for Broadside. Well, that fall, Pete organized a meeting in Manhattan of a group he called Friends of Sing Out magazine, which, of course, you know, affiliated with Broadside. And I went there with my daughters, and somehow or other, the four of us, Pete, me, Carolyn, and Juliet, ended up singing together about Harriet Tubman.
What made him such an iconic leader of the folk movement? Was it the songs he collected and shared, the songs he wrote, the sing-along tradition he fostered?
I think the main thing was who he was and the example he set for all of us as a person. Yes, he taught us to sing along, and he wrote wonderful songs. He also really is the one who popularized Woody Guthrie's songs. I don't know if everyone in the world would be singing This Land Is Your Land without Pete, or Leadbelly's songs, you know, Irene Goodnight, and on and on. He was just such an incredibly stalwart person. In the 50s, he got upset with the Weavers because they were doing a commercial for a cigarette company, and then he quit the Weavers and protested that. So he was way ahead of his time. His values were just, you know, a great model for the rest of us.
How did you come to help preserve the Seeger TV series?
The series was called Rainbow Quest, and he had found someone who was sort of in the TV business, and they put together 39 shows in black and white, no rehearsals. I think each time they recorded two shows at a time to save money in the studio. But the shows were only broadcast on what we had in those days, I think, UHF. So if you didn't have a UHF antenna, you couldn't get Channel 47. And I saw most of them at home. And I've had the idea right then and there, someday I'd like to put them out in movies, I thought, and sell them to libraries. Well, eventually someone invented home video systems, and in the early 80s I wrote Pete a letter proposing to publish the series. And I got a phone call from his manager, Harold Leventhal, whose office was near mine. I had a publishing company in those days, named after Pete's boat. My company was called Clearwater Publishing. And we had a meeting, and eventually Harold liked the idea. Pete liked the idea. I signed the contract with Harold and Sholem, and then we started to copy the tapes. And after we sent them to a top-rated studio in Manhattan, and they said, oh, these tapes are no good. They're flaking off. They're ruining our equipment, and the quality of the output is terrible. So we can't do any more, and you know, so on. Well, we found another place that had a system for cleaning the tapes by running them through a chemical bath, and they wanted $500 a tape, which was way beyond what I could afford. So someone in my office, a husband of a person who made movies, suggested we apply for a grant at the National Endowment for the Arts, which we did. The person who was in charge of grants was an old friend of Pete's, and that's how the shows were preserved. Otherwise, honestly, I think if I hadn't come along, they would have all eventually disappeared.
Norman Ross is president of Ross Publishing, specialists in government reports and microfilm, and formerly publisher of Broadside Magazine, a folk revival Bible whose contributors included the late, great Pete Seeger.
Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, Feedburner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hanger Studio Play It Productions. With intern Sarah Skirmont and Gene Moon, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week last year, we considered mounting protests across Egypt against the rule of elected President Mohamed Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood supporters from our February 3, 2013 broadcast hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
ولذلك قررت دعوة قادة ورموز القوى السياسية للحوار غدا حول الموقف الراهن وتحديد محاور وآليات الحوار.
Violence on the anniversary weekend of the Egyptian Revolution and the days after has taken at least 50 lives, left more than 1,000 injured, and, as we heard, prompted President Mohamed Morsi to declare a state of emergency in three provinces most affected. Former Muslim Brotherhood leader Morsi also called for dialogue with secular opponents of his Islamist-oriented regime, which many of them dismissed as a waste of time, while Egypt's defense minister warned that continued clashes could mean, quote, collapse of the state.
Also last week, collapse of the Syrian state continued in bloody slow motion with increased threat to stability in the region as refugees continued to flee to overcrowded camps across the borders with Jordan and Turkey. Israeli jet fighters flew into blast what Damascus called a research center and others described as a convoy carrying Russian anti-aircraft missiles to sympathetic Hezbollah militants threatening Israel from Lebanon. To consider these and related events, we're joined again by Thanasis Kambanis in Beirut, Lebanon, after a week in Cairo. A Middle East expert for the Century Foundation and a columnist for the Boston Globe and ThanasisKambanis.com, he's the author most recently of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Welcome back to For Your Ears Only.
Great to be with you.
One precipitating cause for the current violence was a wholesale death sentence for 21 young men involved in an earlier fatal soccer riot. It seemed extreme, and some reports say Morsi condoned it to prevent violence threatened by survivors of those killed in the earlier riot. What's your understanding of all of that?
Well, this is one of these sort of unbelievably bungled moves by the transitional government in Egypt. So if you recall, a year ago, this tragic event happened after a soccer game where the fans from one side stormed onto the pitch and slaughtered, with their hands and knives, dozens of members of the fan base of the opposing team. Fast forward a year later, the only people convicted for this are the kids, the sort of hooligan kids with the knives who were on the, you know, front end of the slaughter. Not a single authority suffered even the slightest charge. So, you know, the police who stood by while this happened, the inept security officials and managers who locked the stadium doors so that the people being attacked couldn't run away, the police who then blamed it on foreign interference and didn't investigate it for months on end after it happened. None of the people who really were in charge of this tragedy were touched. And this really touches a deep nerve, because it goes back to the original reason of the uprising and the central cause of dissatisfaction since, which is Mubarak and his cronies and the security services and the people in the military who detain people without cause and so on and so forth. Not a single one of these authority figures has been held to account. And meanwhile, we're shifting into a new era of Muslim Brotherhood authoritarianism, and the idea that there's going to be a reckoning and some kind of transitional justice feels further and further out of reach.
Are the secularists hurting or undermining their own cause by refusing the call for dialogue?
Well, this is one of these false equivalencies that gets batted around a little bit. And let's start by saying, yes, for sure, the secular opposition has been fragmented and politically somewhat dim-witted and reactive. Now, they've also had zero power and zero control of any step of the way since Mubarak's fall. So holding them equally responsible for what's going on now, as by the way, many figures in the U.S. government do, is absurd. The secular opposition in this case has every sort of legitimate reason to say, listen, there's nothing to talk about unless you do X, Y, and Z to show that you're actually interested in some kind of coordination with people outside the Muslim Brotherhood. We're not going to sit down with you, because we tried it before. They have sat down with him before, and it's been embarrassing, because whatever agreements they reached were immediately tossed aside.
What does the defense minister's warning about collapse of the state suggest about the army's willingness to step in, curb violence, and run things again, at least for a while?
Well, my view on this, and again, you know, we all have to admit the military remains pretty much a black box in terms of what their internal deliberations are and how they make these decisions. It was clear by the end of the last phase that they were uncomfortable wielding direct power. It's also clear that they have a lot of contempt both for the Brotherhood and for the secular, the sort of secular liberal movement. But in answer to your question, I think what they would like to do is perhaps see the Muslim Brotherhood flail in the wind and twist for a while and eventually broker a presidency that is more to their liking and that they have a lot of influence over without having to be the presidency themselves.
Let's turn to the instability in Syria, the export of refugees, and now what the Israelis apparently think was the export of weapons to Hezbollah in Lebanon, where you are. Do you expect the Assad regime to attempt any counterattack?
Well, Well, you know, their percentage here is in the political gain they get by appearing to be the victims of an Israeli incursion, Israeli aggression. So that that gives them, or they hope anyway, that it gives them a little bit of credibility with whatever fence sitters remain in Syria and the neighborhood. But you know, they cannot themselves mount a counterattack. They don't have that capability. Hezbollah, their ally in Lebanon, does, right? Hezbollah has the reach and the weaponry and the know-how to mount some kind of attack on Israel. That would be unprecedented, right? It would be unprecedented for Hezbollah, at the urging of a non-Lebanese entity, to make a preemptive attack on Israel. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but what I think is much more likely, if we're going to see some kind of spread of the conflict outside of Syria, it's going to be because of a miscalculation and not because of some kind of calculated retaliation by Syria's allies against Israel.
Do you see a Syrian connection to the fatal bombing at America's embassy in Turkey, which has accepted both anti-Assad rebels and refugees and U.S. anti-missile missiles to defend against Syrian cross-border attacks?
You know, I mean, who knows? there are a lot of folks in this region who have a history of anti-American hostility and of this kind of armed or terrorist strike. So so sure, that's possible. As far as I've seen, there's no evidence one way or another of who's behind this. And you know, frankly, as we saw during the worst years of the Civil War in Iraq as well, this kind of violence really does have a way of spreading outside the borders. If you have, you know, jihadis coming into Syria now and really steeping themselves in the fight, when they leave, there's every chance that some of them will decide to continue their fight somewhere else in some other way.
Thanasis Kambanis in Beirut, Lebanon, after a week in Cairo. A Middle East expert for the Century Foundation and a columnist for the Boston Globe and ThanasisKambanis.com. He's also the author, most recently, of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel.
Egypt's Counter-Revolution, from our February 3, 2013 broadcast. In July, the military stepped in to quash chaos, essentially banning the Muslim Brotherhood, removing Morsi from office and putting him on the path to a criminal trial, at which he appeared last week in the soundproof glass cage. Previously ousted President Hosni Mubarak in a military hospital, faces retrial over killing of protesters in the 2011 uprising. The Egyptian Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is widely expected to run and win the next presidential race, though his increasingly repressive military rule seems overmatched by mounting economic and management challenges. And the Cairo regime also faces increasing terrorist attacks from an al-Qaeda-inspired group, Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, in the wake of folk icon Pete Seeger's passing, a salute to the rock revolution that began 50 years ago this month with the Beatles' U.S. debut on network TV.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan!
Thank you very much. Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's...
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always do. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm kissing the lips and hope that my dreams will come true.